This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Friday, August 26th. I'm Abby Collins. The legal battle continues over a demolished home on Wrangell Avenue in Petersburg. The structure was taken down in 2014 after the borough declared it a dangerous home. The owners of the home are appealing last year's court ruling in favor of the Petersburg borough and have filed another suit challenging borough staff visits to the property in preparation for demolition. Joe Vicknicki reports.
Homeowners Karen Ellingstad and husband Fred Trium had their aging house at 1011 Wrangell Avenue taken down after the borough assembly in December of 2013 declared the structure a dangerous building and ordered it fixed up or removed. The foundation of the home failed in 2009, leaving it resting on toppled pilings. This January, Ellingstad filed suit against the borough alleging violations of the U.S. and state constitutions along with local municipal code. Ellingstad argues that Petersburg's building official at the time, Leo Luzak, and Public Works Director Carl Hagerman conducted searches on the property in January of 2014. Luzak and Hagerman went to the home to take photos and look for any signs of asbestos. That was in anticipation of the borough following through on the demolition order from the month before. The lawsuit characterizes those visits as illegal searches without a search warrant or the homeowner's knowledge or consent. Ellingstad argues those visits violated the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which aims to limit unreasonable searches and seizures by government on someone's property or person. Ellingstad is asking a judge to permanently block the borough from doing future inspections or home visits without prior notice to the homeowners or obtaining a search warrant. She's also asking the court to award damages and have the borough pay the cost of litigation. The borough's attorney, Jim Brennan, responded to the suit by admitting Luzak and Hagerman made those visits and took photos and samples of floor tiles to look for asbestos. However, Brennan argues those were not warrantless searches and were required for the borough to deal with the dangerous building, especially if asbestos was found in the floor tiles. In a court filing, Brennan writes that the visits were not a part of a criminal enforcement action that require a warrant. The case is scheduled for a trial next May. Meanwhile, the court battle is not over for the original administrative appeal of the borough assembly's December dangerous home ruling from 2013. Ellingstad and Trium appealed that decision in court. Last year, Superior Court Judge Philip Pallenberg ruled in the borough's favor in the case, awarding $1,000 in attorney's fees to the municipality. However, Pallenberg in that ruling noted that some of the homeowner's arguments had merit. He wrote that the borough did not provide a good explanation for why it did not provide a packet of materials to Trium and Ellingstad, but provided that information to the borough assembly in advance of the December hearing. Pallenberg wrote, quote, "The borough only prevailed on appeal because appellants made no convincing argument as how the hearing could have turned out differently if they had received the report in advance of the hearing," unquote. The judge cited procedural irregularities in the hearing process over the home demolition and said the ruling was a close question. Trium and Ellingstad have appealed that ruling to the state's Supreme Court. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
The Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission will keep most of its functions for now, after commission supporters fought to protect it from losing certain functions to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Governor Bill Walker put a hold on an administrative order he issued in February, saying he needed more stakeholder feedback. The commission controls the number of licenses in commercial fisheries to ensure their economic health and stability. An audit last year found the state could save up to $1.2 million by consolidating the commission's administrative functions in Fish and Game. Walker says he unfortunately bypassed public engagement in an effort to find cost saving through Administrative Order 279. Kodiak salmon fisherman Bruce Schachtler says he's pleased Walker issued a moratorium on the order.
Well, I think it's a great thing. It's a very governor-like thing to do, to want to involve everybody and to acknowledge that, you know, maybe that's something that got missed.
An earlier department report found a backlog of applications to the commission for permits, with some cases taking more than 15 years to complete. The audit suggested that the state make the three full-time commissioners part-time positions and hire a full-time executive director to manage daily operations. Many commercial fishermen have praised the agency for the speed with which it handles annual permit renewals. And Petersburg gill netter Max Warhatch says the commissioners continue to do worthwhile work.
I do feel strongly that CFEC is something that should be protected.
Fisherman Robert Thorstensen sued to block the administrative order. While a Superior Court judge ruled in favor of the state government in July, Walker decided he wanted more public input before moving forward. Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton says the state will engage stakeholders this fall on how to find cost savings at the CFEC.
Some things are probably going to be pretty easy to agree on. For example, I think even the commissioners last year agreed that they could go to part-time, and so that would be a big cost saving. And then the second issue is what kind of administrative functions could we combine with the department to save money and avoid duplication.
He says the state will begin the engagement process soon. A sculptor who just moved to Petersburg last year opens up a show at Miele Gallery on Main Street tonight, although local art enthusiasts may already be familiar with his artwork. John Poost, originally from Montana, has lived in Alaska for decades and has had his stone sculptures on display at Petersburg galleries for the past 20 years. He expects to show about 28 pieces at the gallery. Joe Vicknicki spoke with him about his work.
Sounds like you've been doing sculpture and art for a long time.
Yeah, actually, I started in 1982. I made a few pieces for my wife. Yeah, she kind of challenged me, soapstone pieces. We were living in Homer, Alaska. Okay. And ended up in Fairbanks in 1984. And I couldn't find a job. There was a glut of oil field people, you know, from the pipeline there. And it was almost impossible to find a job. So I took those pieces to a little art gallery there, and she bought them all and wanted more. And ended up quite a few more, so I just took off from there and haven't looked back, so that's kind of how I got started.
Then how'd you get that start? Did you have training or anything like that? Or
not really.
Oh, okay.
No, my wife just kind of challenged me, thought I could do it, and there just happened to have some place in Homer that had a hunk of soapstone. She already knew that, and so I bought it and just made a few pieces. I didn't really think about selling them at the time. Just were for her, and we were going to keep them. We kept them for a couple years, and then ended up needed to sell them, and then I just started from there. You know,
great.
So yeah.
You work primarily in stone, soapstone, alabaster.
Right now, I'm doing primarily soapstone and alabaster, especially right now soapstone because I've got a new batch of soapstone I buy by the ton from my miner in Washington, and it just fabulous colors. So I'm doing mostly soapstone, but originally I did anything Alaskan. I did fossil ivory, I did whalebone, I did caribou antler, a lot of caribou antler, moose antler, and then soapstone was just one of the many things I did. And then I kind of, in the beginning, I didn't really wholesale too much. I did all, you know, little shows and retailed, and I had some galleries want to approach me and want to buy my stuff more seriously. And it's evolved into mostly soapstone. They wanted my soapstone, so that's kind of where I do limited edition bronzes now too, and that's my focus is the soapstone and the bronzes. I don't really do much of the other stuff. Although now that I'm back here in Alaska, because we were in Montana for a few years, I'm kind of tempted to go back into fossil ivory, and I did really kind of one of a kind high end pieces in that, and it's kind of fun. That a lot of time consumed, but I enjoyed doing it. But
and it's, you've had your stuff on sale here in Petersburg for a while as well.
Yeah, actually, Berthiel Evans, I think the gallery was called Petersburg Gallery or something back then, and that's probably been 20 years. I just, on the way to Ketchikan, because I was selling quite a bit in Ketchikan at the time, I just stopped here on a fluke, and she bought some pieces, and then it just ended up every year. And then Fran Jones bought the gallery, and she continued, and then Beth wanted to continue when she bought the gallery. So yeah, it's been 20 years. I think I've been here every year for almost 20 years. That's how we ended up moving here. We liked it.
Oh, cool. That's good to hear. And just last year. So.
Yep. Right. Just November, right.
Your work is primarily animals and nature of Southeast or of Alaska in general.
Yeah. I used to way back do a few Eskimo pieces, but it's all animals now. And primarily bears, and not because necessarily that's what I want to do. I do like doing them, but that's where my galleries want from me. They want probably 90% bear. So I'm kind of known as the bear carver.
That's what people want to buy when they come to Alaska.
Well, yeah, that's part of it, yeah. But sometimes I wish I could just do more of other things, but, you know, part of it is demand, you know, so.
Sure, okay. Is that soapstone, is that hard to work with?
It can be. You know, like alabaster, you know, is harder, but it's a consistent hard. And so where soapstone can, it varies so much. It can be really soft or it can be super hard. It can be much harder than alabaster. It just depends on the piece. And sometimes you get it mixed into one piece, and that's where it gets difficult. You're working with soft and hard at the same time, and that can be challenging. But
okay. And you just kind of learn that as you go through working with a specific piece of rock.
Yeah, there's a lot of trial and error in, well, any art. I'm sure any artist will tell you that. There's a lot of trial and error and a lot of things you learn over the years, for sure.
An opening for Pooh's show is tonight from 5 to 7 at Miele Gallery. Hundreds of people gathered Thursday at Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve to celebrate the opening of a newly completed Huna Tribal House and the National Park Service's 100th anniversary. Not everyone could make it. Some event speakers and tribal members, and KTOO's LaKadra Chavis, were stuck at Juneau International Airport because of fog near the park. But that didn't stop them from watching the event from afar.
Two decades in the making, the Huna Tribal House celebrates the four major Huna Tlingit clans that lived in the area that became Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. According to the Park Service, villagers fled an advancing glacier hundreds of years ago. Clan members couldn't return to the area because it was taken over by the National Park Service in the 1980s. But as the fog cleared Thursday morning and tribal members paddled to the shore in newly carved canoes, Glacier Bay called its people back to their homeland. Planes traveling to the area weren't able to land. This left about a dozen people, including me, unable to attend. Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of them.
We are sitting here waiting for the fog to lift in Gustavus, along with a fair number of Alaskans who were hoping to go out to be part of the celebration.
She was hoping to catch a late morning flight, but it didn't work out. By that point, the terminal's only television was tuned to live coverage of the event. The last time Murkowski was in Gustavus was in 2012. Officials were trying to break ground for the tribal house.
I saw the details and the plans, so I was really looking forward to being able to see it live and in color, as they say. So maybe we'll yet get out there today, but it remains to be seen.
Across the lobby, Bert Frost is sitting with a couple of his colleagues. He's the regional director for the National Park Service in Alaska. He says it's an important part of American history, and this event emphasizes that Alaska Native history is a part of that.
A lot of people don't understand that there's a Native tie to those lands, that people have lived here. It wasn't just created in 1917. This is the homeland for the Huna Tlingit.
He hopes that the tribal house will help rebuild the relationship between the tribal community and the National Park Service.
We always haven't had a great relationship between the Park Service and the Native people, and so through this effort of building this tribal house and the things that it represents to the Huna Tlingit and what it represents to the National Park Service and the American people, it's sort of a coming together of all these entities.
Adrian Fleek also works for the Park Service as the Alaska Native Affairs liaison.
There's a really big commonality between the mission of our organization of preserving and protecting special places in America for future generations with the Alaska Native way of being of preserving and protecting our resources for the seven generations to come. So I like to highlight that we have some commonalities.
She's planning to meet up with family at the ceremony and is dressed for the occasion.
So I have a traditional Tlingit vest on, and on the back it is a raven emblem, and on the front this is Coho, because I am Raven Coho. Traditionally, when you go to a potlatch or a ceremony, you wear regalia that reflects who you are, who your family is.
And she wasn't the only one sporting regalia. Around the corner, Lillian Austin is watching a live stream of the event. She's wearing a traditional black vest with her tribe's thunderbird stitched on the back, one of the four big clans from Glacier Bay. Austin is a tribal elder who grew up in Hoonah and spent summers in Glacier Bay as a child. Her nephew, Herb Shakely, is one of the carvers for the project. As of Thursday afternoon, she was still waiting for reliable transportation to the event.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it. I got up early for it. Still sitting there. I think our friends are looking for us.
She says, like everyone else in limbo at the airport, she's excited and that she hasn't seen the tribal house either. If weather permits, it'll be the first time she's visited Glacier Bay in more than 50 years. From Juneau International Airport, I'm Lakitra Chavis.
It's Friday, August 26th, and time for our weekly look at financial markets. Joining us by phone from Bellevue, Washington, is Dan Berg, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors. Hi, Dan. What's the news this week?
Hey, Abby. We don't have a lot of news. We had a fairly quiet week. In fact, for the last few weeks, the market hasn't moved very much. In fact, we haven't had this many quiet weeks in a row since 1995. And so people are getting a little nervous. If it's this quiet, you know, what could disturb the quiet? Well, we did get one hint today. Janet Yellen, who is the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, made a case for a rate hike. She didn't say exactly when it might come, but she felt that the economy had strengthened and the case for a rate hike had strengthened in recent months. And so the odds are, looking at the financial markets, that we'll have slightly higher short-term interest rates by the end of the year. And it's also possible we could have a surprise hike in the next meeting in September. Also in the U.S., we had some good news about housing. We had a great new housing starts number in July. Folks are building houses at a greater pace than they have been for a few years. And existing home sales were down, but only because there was somewhat of a lack of inventory. Over in the EU, there was a survey of general business conditions across the EU, and that strengthened, and it showed that there is modest expansion there. Not quite as good as here in the U.S., but something modest, and that's encouraging because folks had been a little bit worried about what might happen after the Brexit vote. So for the week, the Dow Jones closed on modestly, about 180 points. It was 18,397 at the close. The NASDAQ also had a modest decline, very modest at 5,218. That was a decline of about 14 points for the week. And the S&P 500 closed at 2,169. In the commodities area, oil closed down somewhat. We had a fairly nice little rally over the last couple of weeks. That seems to be coming to an end. Crude oil inventories here in the U.S. rose to a fairly high level during the course of this week, and crude closed at $47.35. Gold also came down to $1,321 an ounce from $1,340 last week. Regarding bonds, as you might expect with talk from the Federal Reserve Bank, rates ticked up just a little bit. The 30-year Treasury is at 2.29%. and the 10-year Treasury eased up a little bit to 1.63%.
All right, what individual stocks made the headlines this week?
Well, big drug companies are getting bigger. Pfizer, the largest American-based drug company, symbol PFE, is buying Medivation, symbol MDVN, for $14 billion. They are interested in Medivation's oncology, their cancer drug treatments. Pfizer closed at $34.82, and Medivation, of course, soared to $80.25 a share. Medtronic, symbol MDT, the second-largest medical device company, that closed down somewhat on a good but not great earnings report to $86.60. Mylan was another drug company in the news, symbol MYL, in the news for the bad reason of their EpiPen. I don't know if you have any know of any kids or adults that have severe allergies, but if they have a fairly severe allergic episode, it can be life-threatening, and an EpiPen gives you a very easy injection of epinephrine. And those prices were sharply hiked recently, and Congress is now looking into it because the prices are up 400% in the last 5 years, and it's not a very complicated product. And so anyway, there's a whiff of scandal when Mylan, that stock, closed down to $42.98. And Best Buy surprised us. The electronic superstore symbol BBY closed up nicely to $39.48. Their same-store sales actually improved. And up until now, Best Buy had been sort of a poster child of brick-and-mortar retailers who are suffering at the hands of Amazon and others. But maybe that could be stabilizing. We'll see. And then finally, Alaska Airlines symbol ALK closed at $67.28.
All right, what's coming up next week?
Well, next week, the big news will be the August employment numbers. Toward the end of the week, we'll get a good look at whether or not whether employment has continued strong. The consensus is that there will be somewhat less than 140,000 net jobs added during the course of August. If it's much stronger than that, we could have a negative reaction in the market because it will give the Fed a reason to hike interest rates. We also have some manufacturing data out next week, which will be closely watched. And then regarding individual company news, basically earnings season is over, and so there's nothing of great import there next week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dan. We'll check in with you next Friday.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Dan Berg is a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington.
Listeners are reminded that the information provided is general in nature and may not apply to their personal investment situation. Individuals should consult with their chosen financial professional before making any decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC, member of SIPC. Neither Wells Fargo Advisors nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors.